you, Bradford. Thank you very much. That was lovely. I'll just keep talking till you find my voice. So how about the weather, and how about those Dodgers and those D-backs? And so we're on? We're good? Yeah. Okay, good morning. Welcome to the West Valley Center for Spiritual Living. I'm Reverend Karen Rice, and I really am revved up today for a whole lot of reasons. One, I'm really excited that Reverend Sandra Hopper is going to be teaching our metaphysical Bible class, because we have never done that before. So if we didn't state it yet, Reverend Sandra Hopper is a Unity minister. And so we are opening our doors, and we teach Bible exactly the same. Except that every minister and every teacher of Bible will have their own slant on it and their favorite parables and stories to share. But anyhow, what a great honor. Thank you. It's made my heart very happy to have you and Wes here today. I love you, Wes. Good to see you. And so I'm talking today about something that became way more important than I knew when I chose the title and when we started moving in the direction of looking at what we were going to talk about for all these months. And the title of my message is True Spirituality, and I did really tease before we came out, right? During the prayer and after the prayer and before the prayer that we do back there, I did really tease it's going to be the second most important talk I've ever delivered. So I'm glad you're all here. Aren't you glad you're here for the second most? I have no idea what the first was, but it just, you know, I just got this feeling this is top five stuff we're doing today. So I'm glad you're all here. And the title of the message is True Spirituality, but I want to be really clear before we start off here. We are not talking about spirituality as though there is a true and a false, or a right and a wrong. We are talking about true spirituality as something much deeper than a way that we measure our own progress. So everything I'm intending to say this day is a very universal, it's a gentle sharing of some very gorgeous ideas that have been sort of haunting me all week. I just know this is a message that it's time to say, and it needs to be said today. So if you feel any guilt or like you haven't done something good enough, it's on you, because I'm not giving that message in any way, shape, or form. I'm talking today about what it means to look at life as precious, how we can determine what true spirituality means to us individually. So I found this fabulous quote from Ernest Holmes in one of those books that is indeed more than, it was printed 100 years ago. Imagine that. Imagine these words being around for 100 years, and who knows how many ministers have read these words from the pulpit. Ernest Holmes said, "My idea of true spirituality is that a person should live a perfectly normal life." Not what you expected, is it? "Just like other people, neither better nor worse, entering into and enjoying all of life." Amen. What a beautiful light. Do you see the gentleness in that? That your life is exactly fine. You know, it's just us, we get confused when we start comparing our lives or our enlightenment, our level of enlightenment, or our depth of spirituality. You can only be where you are, and I can only be where I am. And Holmes seemed to intuit that even as a young man. So what we're talking about this morning is living life. Yes, I will say it has to do with living our life consciously and intentionally, because we talk about that every week. But more than that, we're looking at living our life in a way that we are enjoying it at least most of the time. If you're not enjoying your life most of the time, there's a lesson here for you today. Don't feel guilty. Don't be grateful. Be grateful. You have some gem to take home today. And then the other idea I wanted to talk about in terms of true spirituality is that I think the idea of having a spiritual community, a place of worship, somewhere, whether it's formal or informal, whether it's a conversation circle or an experience in nature, or it's coming into a sanctuary on a Sunday morning or whenever, I think that the purpose of all of that is twofold. It's one, to get the information, to understand that the whole idea of spiritual traditions have always been about preparing us with tools, equipping us with tools to meet our everyday experiences. But the second part of that is the way we come together in community. Because see, it is a personal, individualized path, but we never do it alone. We never do it alone. So the way that we meet as community is really a way that we have an opportunity to see that, yeah, we think a little different than everybody else, and that there are contrasts in life that are beautiful lessons and that show us the beautiful color, how colorful living can be if we wrap our minds around seeing the beauty and feeling the essence and breathing the freedom of life itself. So as we take time to notice that our experiences, that every experience we encounter is a holy encounter, everything we teach God, there is no place where God is not. So God has to be right here, and God has to be right here now in the middle of whatever your now is at that moment, in every experience that you walk through, in every person that you encounter along your own walk of life. And so what we know is that as we begin to pay attention to that, as we let God out of that little box we've had God in for so long, that we begin to reshape our world. Don't lose sight of that. As long as you are here and you still have a breath to take in this life, there is a way to grow. We need to be teachable. It's an invitation for us to remember that there's always tomorrow. There's always that next area of growth. Even the idea of the death or the human body not serving us anymore frees us to have more life in the next plane, whatever that might be. Well, how about amen? Oh, it's good news. It's always good news. So I want to make this real personal today. When we begin to recognize that, because this is where it gets sticky, a new thought, we try and be good all the time. We try and be nice, and we have this idea that positive thinking changes our life, and it does. We know that all of that is true. But what we miss sometimes is that it's the everyday stuff that grows us. It's the contrast that shapes us. And therefore, all of us have opinions. You do. And judgments. We do. And ideas and beliefs about what's going on in the world, what's happening in our life, understanding the other members of our family, everything. We are always trying to make sense of our own life. And that's just the nature of being human. So what I'm going to say today is that what if we could lighten up and see that our opinions and our judgments and our ideas and our beliefs serve as a part of the way we get the contrast to see and acknowledge the differences, to not be afraid of difference, and that we always have the opportunity to adjust the color tones. You know, in when we first got color TV, I must have been between 8 and 10 years old, I'm going to guess. Bring in our first color TV, and it was a big deal to get that color TV in your house. And then the networks on TV started promoting in living color. They would say that certain shows were going to be in living color. Remember that, Dorothy? Yes, of course you do. And what the reason they said that was because not everything was in color, that a lot of the shows were still in black and white, so it was a really big deal when you had your color TV, when you could tune in and see something in color. And then the TVs had something very interesting about them. It reminds me kind of my computer monitor. There were all these little buttons for contrast, for brightness, for tint, tint was always where we had a problem in my house. Daddy liked it more red. Mom liked it more green. They were never happy. They were always readjusting each other's idea of the perfect tint to see the color that was almost like real color. But it was living color. We were told that for sure. So what I was thinking about all that is that, you know, even as young children growing up, we are given guidance as to how to live to be socially acceptable as we grow. That's a goal of the parent, right? To try and get your kid to not stick out, to be unique and special, but not too much, so that they don't break too many of the rules and that they get through childhood safely. And I was thinking how that we really do, by the nature of trying to train our children to do well, we teach them about good and bad. We teach them what's okay to do in public, what's not. We teach them to, manners and things. And we therefore begin teaching them right and wrong without intending to teach right and wrong. But here's what I thought. When you learn to tie your shoes, there's a right way to do that, and then there are other ways to do that. And I think because I was left-handed and my mother was not left-handed, I didn't learn to tie my shoes the right way. And so I could go through my life being mad at my mom. I could try and learn to do it the other way, but that doesn't seem worth my time. But the result of it is that I could never tie. I had these three daughters, and I could never tie pretty bows in their dresses, you know, or in their hair, because I don't do it in the appropriate way that makes a pretty bow. So it doesn't matter. Can you see that it really doesn't matter? But there is that differentiation, that contrast, and that's what we're here to learn. I think that each and every one of us has come here to help teach each other, not just the people in your family, but we are constantly teaching each other, and we are learning from others, often because of the things they do that bother us, right? Or the things that we see them do, and then we get a lesson like, oh, I don't want to do that. Oh, I want to be kinder in my life. And so we can always use it in a positive way. It doesn't have to be a judgment that is putting another person down, but it's just the way that contrast shows up. It's a colorful life. Even if you're colorblind, it's a colorful world out there. So as children, we learn to work in pairs of opposites, and I believe it is so that we can then learn to use our experiences to continue growing our life. I mean, let's face it, nobody knows what it's like to be in somebody else's skin. I think about that a lot. Nobody knows that. And so as a minister, when I was a young minister, I was in my 50s, but when I was a new minister, this quotation from Emerson used to really make me feel so comfortable. Rejoice in the discontent of others, for they are growing. Rejoice in the discontent of others, for they are growing. And as I thought about that, I actually found that on a note on my desk. It was stuck to something else, and it fell down, and there it was on my desk yesterday, I think. And as I played with that thought, I remembered that Ken Kise in the 60s or the 70s has this fabulous quotation that I had before I had a computer monitor, so I know it wasn't a sticky note on a monitor. I don't even know if I had sticky notes then. I've had this quote in my life so long. But these are the words of Ken Kise from about 1970. I feel with loving compassion the problems of others without getting caught up emotionally in their predicament, because their predicament is offering them the message they need for their own growth. That quotation helped me tremendously raising my children. I feel with loving compassion the problems of others without getting caught up in the emotionality of the predicament, because the predicament is exactly where they're learning. And quite frankly, most of us know this at some point or another, but you can't teach them. They have to figure it out on their own, because they have to bump into their own things and have their own experience of contrast and difference. So we begin to realize, as we dedicate ourselves to spirituality, we begin to realize that the troublesome things that happen in life often hold a gift or something we can learn so that we have more wisdom than we used to have. And sometimes the very troublesome things that hit us in life and stop us cold are the most potent lessons that we will ever have. And the reason for that is when something broadsides us or startles us and something unexpected occurs and you just didn't see it coming, it stops all the routine normal and we lose our space of your comfort zone is shattered. Because those incidents can break us in such a way that they break apart all of the old routines, all of the old habitual beliefs and ideas that we just have been assuming were true for so long. And it gives us a sort of a clean slate. Things slip away. Maybe it's so traumatic you can't even imagine how life is going to be now that this big change has happened. And all of us have lived through things like that. And I think the beauty of it is that it tells me we are always capable of reinventing ourselves. We are always capable of stopping our routine and asking ourselves, am I still being fed by all these things I'm doing? Is this a life? Am I on the course or do I need to alter my course a little bit? Stuff gets in our face so that we might wake up and be more alert or attentive. But what I always try and remember is that stuff comes to pass. Right? I love that idea that it's many times in the Bible it says, and it came to pass. It came to pass. It didn't come to haunt you. It came to pass. You get to decide what you want to do with it, whatever it is. But I think that that's why I read once that betrayal is the most human of experiences, and that every adult, I don't know if it's true or not, but I read it, that every adult, before you are done with this life, you will have been betrayed at least once, and most of us will have experienced betrayal more than one time. Now, I think betrayal is the big lesson, because real betrayal only happens in the most intimate of relationships where it feels like trust has been broken. And so it's that experience that you didn't see coming, and then something happens that disrupts your relationship with another human being or life in some way, but people are usually, you know, we usually feel betrayed. And then once you have that feeling, it's as though it has the power to cancel out everything that happened in your life before that, that it just wasn't true. And it makes us feel foolish, like, why didn't I see that coming? And so it also holds the best, the ripest place for growth and for movement. And that's what I want to talk about today, is you can't cancel out your whole life, every relationship and every special moment, every holy encounter. Nobody can take those away unless we feel betrayed and we use that as a weapon against that person. And we keep that in place to protect our, we think we're going to protect ourselves. So we feel wounded. That's why betrayal is so profound. We feel wounded, and it's likely that sense of woundedness has come from our own shadowed perception of a complicated event. But it's just an experience that came to pass. And the problem is that we don't let it pass, especially the big things that we pick at them. We analyze it. We try and figure out why. We won't leave it alone, and so we keep it raw. I want to tell you a story that I read this week. It was a story about a Buddhist man on a journey, and he's traveling all by himself. And he comes to this river, and the river is fast flowing in swift waters, and there's no bridge, there's no boat, and it's dangerous right now on this side of the river. He needs to get on the other side of the river for safety. And so he's frightened. He doesn't know what to do for a minute, and then he looks around and he sees that there are scraps of wood and bushes and branches off trees, limbs with leaves on them still. And he realizes, hey, I can take what's right in front of me and I can make a raft. And he starts weaving it all together and he makes a small but very sturdy raft. And he gets himself across the river. And once he's on the other side and he sees that he's safe, that really this is a safe place to be, and he's so thankful, and he looks at this raft that he created with his own hands, and he's so proud of it. And he picks it up, and he's thankful that he was able to cross the other side, and he picks it up, and he decides he must carry it with him wherever he goes. But it's heavy. And the thing is, when we feel burdened in life or betrayed or hurt, especially when it's a relationship with other people, it's difficult to put it down. But if you don't put it down, it'll get heavier and heavier and heavier. When we make a story up in our mind about what we think happened, then we keep thinking of the story. Do you ever notice how easy that is to do? You're walking along and you're going, you know what I should have said? You know, so you rehash it again and again and again, and you're keeping the wound open and you're creating more pain for yourself. So I think the story suggests to us that there's a point where it's a good idea to put down that raft, even though it got you from the danger zone into a safer place. You don't need that raft to protect yourself anymore. And in fact, it's not doing anybody any good to keep carrying it around. A wound never heals when we keep describing it, when we keep reliving it, when we need to tell it to yet one other person to explain why we are the way we are. And because people would just understand if they knew our whole story. Well, everybody has a whole story, right? Nobody knows what it's like to be in anybody else's skin, because that's not none of our business. And so healing happens. Don't be upset now. Just ride this out. Gentle. Think of this gently. Healing happens through forgiveness. And forgiveness sometimes is asking us to surrender our attachment to the story of what we think happened. It's not to say the facts didn't happen. It's not to say that you didn't feel wounded in some way. But the idea of forgiveness, eventually, what I hope that all of us will figure out is that if the whole story was known on both sides, it would bring light, a light of true understanding. We rarely know the whole story. Rarely know. And the part we make up is the motive. Oh, I know why she did that. And then you start making up this elaborate story, but none of it is true, because we are not privy to all of the facts. So the facts may be real, but the details about the motives, the motivation of why it happened, seldom is real. Emma Curtis Hopkins said it this way: it has been found that what we vision steadily causes our thinking. It has been found that what we vision steadily causes our thinking. And what do we know about our thinking? Our thinking causes our life. Everything comes from that seed, from first cause, and comes into form or comes into effect through that thought. So we are always creating or co-creating or participating or not participating in our own lives. But here's the thing. If you choose not to participate, you have made a decision. And life will have a response to that decision too. So you're always connected to what's happening or not happening in your very own life. Now, if I was going to thin it out and help it make more sense, I would say that life is holy, that all of life and all of experiences are holy, and that when we get shocked out of our comfort zone, we have a reaction to that. Maybe we wallow in maybe we have self-pity, maybe we have anger, maybe we're carrying disappointment, but we have a reaction, but the reaction is useful to get our attention. Or we can carry it around, we can carry it around like the raft, carry it around until one day it's so heavy you notice you're still carrying it. And then you know what you get to do? Choose again. Make a different choice. Take that raft and put it by the side of the river and let the high tide come and wash it away. It came to pass. So when you find yourself in self-pity or whatever, anger, whatever that is, you see that it has a positive side, and that is that you can recognize it, that you can then choose to release it. But you have to choose to release it. So the most powerful inquiry is not, why did that happen? The most powerful question we could ask is, what do I want to do with this information now? How do I want to put my next foot forward? How will I respond to life? Some of the experts say that when big change happens in our life, it's really valuable to sit in the neutral zone for a while and don't do anything, don't make any decision for a while. Sit in the sacredness of that neutral zone while all that stuff is happening. Now, I want to be really clear, because as I was writing this, I was thinking, well, it really sounds like God tests us. It really sounds like I'm saying God is testing us. And I have to tell you that we, in the science of mind, we don't teach that, and I don't believe that personally. I believe that it's not like God, you're here to learn a lesson, and so God's going to throw it out for you. It's not like you're here to learn a lesson, and God has to strong-arm you into, you know, throw the gauntlet down so you'll get the point. All of that stuff is because of the way we choose to walk through our lives. Whether or not we are able to see and interpret what's right in front of us is up to us. So it's not, from my opinion, in my view, and I have a lofty view for a short person, from my view, it's not God testing us, but it's the way life works. And that's what's so important about the message today. It's just the way life works. And so we work through our what we think we see going on. Something happens in our life. It feels like no one is there to help us. And we look at what remains and we build a raft. Lo and behold, the solution to the problem is already right here. There are twigs and there are limbs and there are leaves, and we can weave things together in a new way, and we can carry ourselves to safety, and then we can let the raft go. I was thinking of that fabulous astronaut movie, the one where, true story, where they get up there and something goes really wrong, and they have to find all the parts, that any materials that are in the space capsule with them, any material at all that they might be able to use, and then all the wizards down in Houston or wherever, or Cape Canaveral, Cape Kennedy, all those smart people now come together and they pull all their intelligence to take these few items, only what's in front of those astronauts, and they have to find a way to save their lives, to get them back to Earth. And they did. Everything we need is already given. So what we want to do is free ourselves up so that we can continue on the journey. We want to rise above betrayal. We want to rise above feeling like a victim and know that sometimes it has to be painful before it gets our attention. I don't think it has to be, but for some of us, we do experience that. And ultimately, if we really start wrapping our mind around this in a new way, ultimately we will realize that forgiveness is not blaming anyone else or anything else for our discontent. Hear that. Forgiveness is not blaming someone or something else for our own discontent, because healing of every sort is an inside job. That's what we teach, an indwelling presence of God. And so we come here on this planet, I believe, on this life class, to learn through our personal experiences to get clearer and clearer about the indwelling presence, about the way the materials are already given to us, that the grace of God is always flowing, that there's always that divine guidance, those masterful scientists that saved the space team. We teach that, and this is so important. I think it's the whole beauty of New Thought in general. I love that there's such a large group of people that have these beliefs, that there isn't, God is an indwelling presence, that God is not an entity, that there is that power and that presence that is greater than we are. It is in every experience we ever have. And I'm going to say this again, but this time I'm going to ask you to listen carefully and to try and personalize what I'm about to say in such a way that it's like you have never heard it before. This is the first time you have ever heard these words. If there is no place that God is not, then there is something divine in every experience we encounter. And though we are not tested by God to prove that we're worthy, we're not earning special points for some party in the afterlife later, we are not tested, and yet the universal laws that are in place are the laws that we can learn how to use, and we, by moving through our experiences and having our reactions, are testing out the laws. It's not God punishing you. It's not something trying to get your attention. It's your own desire for more peace and more love or more goodness, whatever it is. It's your own desire making itself manifest before you, and the tools you need to pass through that trial are already given. Louisa May Alcott said, "I am not afraid of storms, for I am learning how to sail my ship." I'm not afraid of storms. That's how I learn. If God is not an entity, and I am suggesting and always stand on this, I don't believe that God is an entity. I think the problem is that many thousands of years ago, it was said that we are created in the image and likeness of God, and we have returned the favor. We have made God in our mind look like us. And that is so limiting. So if God is not an entity, what if God is a verb, not a noun, active, action? Then we can understand that the sacredness of life is that life is that process, that movement, that aliveness, and that if God is life, God is a process in addition to every other way we understand intelligence and joy and peace and goodness. And therefore, we are always looking for that godly encounter, because it's always right in front of us. So, you know, we come to learn, and it seems like there are so many religions that talk about the triune nature of spirit. We call it the triune nature of God in New Thought. We look at the Holy Trinity, the three faces of God, and it mingles out way bigger than Christianity, way before. It predates Christianity. So what is that? The Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. What is that? Well, this is what we all have in common, is that every religion has a story of creation. And so many religions use this idea of a Father God that created all of creation. And we, humanity, are the Son. There's the Father, the Creator, and there is that which is created. And then there's this wonderful mystical place. Holmes puts it right in the middle of that symbol there. That is the Holy Spirit. It is the soul. It is that place where we activate the law. So the Holy Spirit is all this divine action. But we are a part of all of it. We are always calling it forward or turning our back on it. We are always participating in creating our own lives. So in New Thought, we would say there's spirit, soul, and body. Humankind, everything in physical form, comes from that first cause. And these are the things we talk about in all those classes. So yes, I don't want to diminish the fact that there are consequences to the words you use. There are consequences to the thoughts we have. But this knowledge should not be fearful to you. It should be really good news, because if we don't like what we create and form, we can change it by changing our mind, by having new thoughts, by taking new actions. If you are alive and sitting here or listening to this in any way, you got more to grow, or you wouldn't be here. And so I thought I would close this morning with this fabulous quote from Ernest Holmes. I think it's just the perfect way of concluding this second most important thing I've ever said from this platform. Holmes says, "One of the most important things to remember," I always pay attention when he says that. This is from your Science of Mind textbook. You can find it on page 194. 194, in case you missed that page in the Science of Mind textbook, 194. "One of the most important things to remember is that we are always causing something to be created. Whatever cause we have set in motion must produce some kind of effect. The question is, are we producing the effects that we would like to experience? We cannot beat nature at her own game, for we are a part of the game she is playing. Shall the result of our lives be a comedy or a tragedy? We are given the will to decide. This is the day. This is the day that the Lord has made. Every encounter is a holy encounter, because life is that process that God is. It is activity and movement, and it is in every experience. It is in every condition we encounter. There is no place that God is not. And this is good news. And in addition to that, the tools you need to get through any challenge are already right where you are too." Let's anchor these ideas in the words of prayer. I would ask at this time that the ministers and the practitioners stand and circle the sanctuary so that we can anchor our consciousness in a unified way. So just take a nice deep breath. Let down the weight of anything you may be carrying on your shoulders, or anything weighing heavily in your mind. We just set everything aside, and we turn within. We begin to recognize that power, that presence, that infinite intelligence of all the universe that is present right here, right now. And we know that it is a power that is greater than we are. We are all that God is, but God is more. God is that activity of life that is our life. And so let's just feel the love of God within, and know that that inner movement is the reflection of the indwelling presence and our recognition of it being there. It is a God-given gift that everywhere we are is that divine wisdom. All the knowledge of the universe, every material we need to get ourselves out of danger. Feel the love of God moving and swirling through this room even now. Spirit itself, as grace, as love, as that beautiful peace that is the ultimate sense of contentment within. We feel and know that there is that power that is here, and that everything we do, every step we take, is guided and directed, and that the light of God, the love of God, that divine illumination, and all the intelligence of this universe is blessing us. And so wherever there appears to be a sign of illness or physical limitations, we know that God is even in the cells of our body, that the words of this prayer activate that quickening within us, so that even in this exact moment we are restored to health, restored to the fullness of all that might be. We open ourselves to be a container to receive the blessings that are pouring and streaming into our lives even now. We become that point of reference that allows us not to fear life, but to know that everything we need is given, and that every experience is just come to pass. And we are here to grow. We are here to love. We are here to be spiritual beings in this amazing path. True spirituality can only be defined individually. And so I feel this gratitude within me. I feel it rising. I feel it moving. It's activated by the joy that I feel in knowing that prayers are answered, that life responds to us, that this life is good, it is precious, it is holy. And I am ever so grateful. And in this deep, deep place of gratitude, we simply release the words of this prayer, knowing that in truth, it is already done. And together we say, and so it is.